Good afternoon and welcome to Citizens Actuarial and Underwriting Committee meeting that is publicly noticed in the Florida Administrative Register to convene immediately following the Audit Committee. Bonnie is placing the placards up at the front and it will just take a couple of minutes to convene. Thank you for your patience. Those in attendance through the public link are automatically in listen-only mode. Thank you for identifying yourself prior to addressing the committee. I'll begin with roll call. Chairman Baruff.
Here.
Governor Fields.
Here.
Governor Dunbar.
Here.
Governor Thomas.
Here.
Fred Strauss.
Here.
Chairman, you have a quorum.
Thank you. Entertain a motion to approve the prior meeting's minutes. Second.
Second.
Motion passes. Thank you. Ms. Montero, I guess. Mr. Donovan, there you are. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Baruff and committee members. I'm Brian Donovan, Chief Actuary for Citizens, and I will discuss A-rates. It's been a long time since we discussed A-rates at the committee or board meeting, so I'll just give a quick brief summary of what A-rates are.
I love this place. This is the one that doesn't, OIR doesn't say anything about.
That's correct. So, subject to the approval of the OIR, insurers in the state of Florida may designate buildings to be subject of advisory rates, aka A rates. And really, A rates are applied to structures that have unique characteristics and should be treated differently than regular manually rated rates risk. In 2006, Citizens filed and received approval from the OIR to A-rate any building whose coverage amount was greater, was $10 million or greater. This applies to both CRW and CRM structures. In 2010, Citizens reached a peak of A-rated structures of just under 1,100. Over the years since then, that risk count dwindled down to a low of 13 in 2019. But now we're starting to see some signs of these risks coming back to Citizens and increasing counts. So A-rates are not subject to OIR approval process and not restricted by the glide path. We have evaluated the A-rates for CRM and CRW and recommend we implement the full indications. For CRM, we are proposing a 29.3% increase. And for CRW, we are proposing a 19.2% increase. I'll pause there for any questions or comments before I read the action item.
Please read the action.
Staff proposes that the ANU committee review and if approve, recommend to the Board of Governors to approve the proposed rate changes to Citizens A rates effective 8/1/2022. And authorize staff to take any appropriate or necessary action consistent with system change implications and other relevant activities.
Board will entertain a motion.
Move staff recommendation.
Second.
Paper signal by saying aye.
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 Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Kelly Booten for the record. Behind tab 3. We have some recommended product changes. As part of our ongoing efforts to streamline the underwriting process and refine eligibility guidelines, staff reviewed questions from agents that arise during the underwriting process, eligibility concerns that emerge from underwriting and claims, ran it by the agent roundtable, the MAC, provided and sought input to really hone in on efficiency. So we have a set of eligibility requirements that help clarify rules, and we have form changes that bring us up to ISO standards and industry comparison and seek to tighten up our forms and make it more clear on what we do and do not, what isn't eligible, and help with some of our product language for claims use. We have other litigation language changes that we're working on, and Tim's going to report on that at the board tomorrow that we'll bring back in July. So for today, on the first page is the product updates, really just tightening up the language to make it clear what business use is acceptable, the farm eligibility rule, adult daycare, adult family care, and assisted living facility usage, daycare rental, simplifying the rule, creating a definition for exotic animals. We picked up on things that were driving phone calls, and this was one of them. So we made it easy for the agents to go look it up. Material misrepresentation, arson and fraud rule, changing that to align timelines to 15 years for all types. We added changes for SB 76 on the glide path so that we don't have to come back every year and ask for that approval. It's just gonna be there with the glide path. And then we cleaned up an eligibility rule as part of the eligibility time changes. These are all significant items in the executive summary. On this next page are all the form changes that are highlighted in the executive summary. And then there's an appendix that goes into way more detail on every change. And there's an indicator on whether it was a change driven by ISO standard forms, the market. There's a couple in there that the OIR recommended. It really has to do with modernizing our language. We haven't changed the forms in a long time. So things like home sharing wasn't even recognized in our policy form. So we added language to address that and just tighten up the rules. We did not increase or expand coverage. We introduced a few limits that weren't there. We added a couple of items I will cover at the beginning and then ask any questions because I don't want to read the whole document to you. The first one expands the scope of actual cash value calculation to include labor, overhead, and profit, taxes, and fees. This applies to claim settlements when payment for replacement cost coverage is contingent upon repairs being incurred and only ACV is initially paid. This is an industry trend, including this in the holdback. And there's a additional language requiring that the insured must incur the cost for matching undamaged items that are included in the claim estimate before payment will be made on those items. And then the other one I wanted to draw your attention to was an example of emerging language. It's just the fourth bullet down, update policy language to exclude coverage for smoke damage unless claim is reported within 180 days of the date the fire is extinguished. And then the list goes on to explain all of the form changes that we're including.
Any questions?
Any questions?
Board?
Yes, please.
Yes.
Ms. Booten, I was reading on the first page of this appendix. It seems like we're updating the business use definition. Do we cover homes that are, I guess, home sharing, you know, Airbnb?
No.
So, I'm sure we probably do, but we just don't know it. But I guess a better question would be, if someone buys a Citizens policy, one of the exclusions is that they cannot rent their home on any home sharing platform. Is that fair?
We don't include claims regarding if it's home shared. And I'm going to ask Karen Holt to really state it more succinctly. She's on, our principal product manager on the line to make sure that it's accurately stated. I want to make a phone call here.
Yeah, good afternoon. This is Karen Holt. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So on the home sharing, what we're doing right now is we're adding some industry language to clearly state that those home sharing risks are not covered. Right now, there could be some gray area that where we might get into covering some of them. So we're adopting some much stronger industry language to make sure that we don't cover those risks. They're not eligible, but to your point, we don't always know about them. So we think this new language is appropriate.
Okay, so we do cover homes that are rented on Airbnb or whatever, but we won't, that's a bad question. We write policies for individuals who may Airbnb their home, but any liabilities that arise from home sharing activities are not covered by a Citizens policy.
So we currently do not write them, but we probably have some because it's not always disclosed. So we don't currently write them, but in the event that we have one, we wanted to tighten up the policy language to address any loss exposure.
So they would become ineligible technically.
Okay. All right. Thank
you. Once we know about them, yeah, we would non-renew them.
Correct.
Definitely. But it's one of these things where people don't disclose it or it changes after they've bought the policy. So we thought that the coverage exclusion in the policy is appropriate in addition to the eligibility requirements or limitations.
This is very similar to like adult daycare where they're not eligible and we might have them. So we we carefully look at our book to find them, and then we would non-renew them if we uncover that.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question about the sharing and the coverage. So right now we don't cover it, but what happens if somebody has a policy with us and they make a claim while they're joined Airbnb and the tenant for 2 weeks does something that creates an insurance claim? Do we just say we're not paying? I'm just
correct.
Yeah. Generally it would.
So the person moves back into the house 3 weeks later because it's their primary residence that they leased out. What happens?
This is Karen again. It would depend on the circumstances of the loss. There are, and that's the reason we're tightening up the language. There are some loopholes in the policy where there would be coverage, and that's why we wanted to tighten it up. Now, in many cases, if it was a relatively new policy and they disclosed on the application that they do not rent the property out to other people, then we would have the opportunity to go back and look at a coverage denial or a rescission of the policy for misrepresentation. But that's not always possible. So that's why we're also tightening up the coverage language.
Okay, so what are we going to end up with in the new document? If you participate in home sharing, you are, the policy doesn't pay. Is that, should it be that clear, or is it going to be that clear?
The policy is going to say that if you, for losses that occur while home sharing is happening, there will not be coverage.
All right. So then that's what I'm trying to get to. So you've got a homeowner who decides to trade his house in the month of August and go to Spain. Okay. So his tenant comes in and something happens in the month of August when he's there, you're not going to cover the claim. That's obvious, right?
The
person moves back into their primary residence in September and there's a claim. We're going to cover that claim?
If they have a claim while the owner-occupant, the policyholder is back in the house, yes, we would cover it.
Okay, why wouldn't we as an insurance company just preclude people from getting insurance if that is what they're going to do?
Well, and we do ask questions on the application at the time they buy the policy, and they have to declare to us that they don't rent the home. However, okay,
however,
we don't always know. So in the event they come to us, in your example, in September, and maybe they've had a kitchen fire that happened while the insured is back in the house, we would likely never know that it had been rented in August. And it wouldn't have been it wouldn't fall under that exclusion at the time of the loss. We would, if we knew about it, non-renew the policy.
Okay. That's exactly my point. Why don't we just, if we can prove that the people rented their home for any length of time during the time of the policy, this just qualify the claim period.
We would do what under case law, and under existing statute and all the laws, if we can, we will. If we determine, and we do it all the time on adult daycare, if we determine that this is happening and they've lied to us, we will rescind the policy and say, you never had a policy with us under the misrepresentation option. However, if we find out during the course of another claim that they might have rented the property out 2 months ago, depending on how old the policy is or the other circumstances, we might or might not be able to rescind it. We would certainly evaluate that. And that's probably a question we'd want to toss over to Jay for a little bit more depth on how claims would handle those.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead. I think what it would require for us to rescind it would be that the application have a material misrepresentation. So that if in the course of investigating one claim, we found out that they rented the home out or did an Airbnb 3 months earlier, and that was wholly unrelated to that particular claim, it'd be probably pretty difficult to rescind the policy then. We put mark them for non-renewal, but I don't think that would probably qualify as the kind of material misrepresentation because of the, and Jay can correct me if he's, because of the discrepancy between what the misrepresentation was and what actually gave rise to the claim.
Right. I agree.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Anybody have any other questions?
All right. May I read the recommendation?
Please.
Staff proposes that the Actuarial and Underwriting Committee review and, if approved, recommend the Board of Governors approve the described product update proposals to update citizens' product guideline forms and supporting documents, and authorize staff to take any appropriate or necessary action consistent with the product updates, March 22 action item, to include filing with the Office of Insurance Regulations, system changes, updates to supporting documents, applications or forms, and other relevant activities. Final changes in implementation timeline may vary based upon project complexity and feedback from the office.
Motion to approve.
I'll move what you said.
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. We're good. Thank you.
All right. And the next one is behind tab four, or it's actually still behind tab three, FIGA 2022 FIGA assessment. The Florida Insurance Guarantee Association Board of Directors certified the need for a 1.3% regular assessment on its members insurers at its February 28, 2022 meeting. The assessment is necessary to secure funds for the payment of recovered claims relevant to new insolvencies in FIGA's other account. The Office of Insurance Regulation issued an order on March 11th that levies a 1.3% regular assessment on all covered lines of business except auto pursuant to Florida statutes. Citizens and member insurers will be required to collect an equivalent surcharge on new and renewal policies with effective dates beginning July 1st, 2022 through June 30th, 2023. If there are no questions, I will read the recommendation.
Yes. Mr. Dunbar.
I couldn't find that FIGA's done two assessments. Right. And I couldn't find where the first assessment was brought to the board just from an information standpoint. So just make sure that everybody's aware, because it wasn't at the last day in new committee meeting, because I just went through.
Yeah, I think I might have done that. I have to go back and look. I did bring it forward, and because we found the action item and copied it from this one. So it was either in the September board meeting.
That's why I just went back there to look. It doesn't matter. I just making sure that the board knows that we have two assessments for a total of 2%. Because my next question was going to be, what's the total assessment that we're passing on to our insurers?
The dollar amount?
Yeah, the dollar amount.
I don't have
2% the budget premium. Right. So it's about, so 600 million?
Yep.
Or 60 million? $60 million. And so going to the math that you gave us at the FIC meeting on the average homeowner, right? It was like 2,400, I think, was that the math?
Yeah, it was almost 5, I think.
So our folks will probably be getting around a $50, right? Am I doing that right?
Yeah.
So just trying, I'm just really bringing it up for the other board members so they realize, particularly in the context of tomorrow's discussion on reinsurance rates, assessments, and putting it in you know, the bigger macro construct, that because of FIGA, we're going to be assessing the average citizen's policyholder around $50. Over the next year to cover the losses in the Guarantee Association.
It's 2% based on the average policy cost of $2,400.
Yeah.
That's 48 bucks.
$48. Okay. And the reason is because we're going to be discussing surcharge and assessment potential exposure.
And inflation increases.
And so you just kind of, you know, put it all in context of what when we were having the discussions at the FIGA meeting over the last two, I think we're going to probably have another. I mean, I think, Jennifer, you dialed in. It looks like we may be having additional assessments from FIGA before the end of this year. So it's just it's an ongoing problem, but I just wanted to pass that on for everybody's benefit.
And the irony, of course, is the main thing we get from FIGA are new insureds. The main thing we get from FIGA are new insureds. Once their companies go belly up.
It's a double hammer. We get to come over here, they get to pay our rates, and then we get to assess them on top of for the previous company.
They get to pay lower rates than they were paying when we take them over.
Insolvent company. Correct. Yes.
I've been beating that drum, so thank you.
Would you like me to read the recommendation?
I think so.
Okay. Staff proposes that the actual and underwriting committee review and, if approved, recommend the Board of Governors provide approval for staff to take appropriate actions necessary to implement the policyholder surcharge and submit payments as described in this Florida Insurance Guarantee Association action item as required by FIGA and the Office of Insurance Regulation.
Second. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you very much. And I'm passing the gavel, I think, right? Or is there another meeting I got to handle? Goes to Mr. Nelson Telemaco. This meeting's adjourned. Next.
Thank you, Chairman.